You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have Alistair McLeod with us once again. We're very privileged to have him at a time like this when markets seem to be spiraling out of control and craziest markets that, well, I've seen some crazy ones, but this may be one that takes the cake. We'd like to remind you that Alistair puts out what I think is a must-read article every Thursday. You can access it by going to goldmoney.com. Go to the research page at goldmoney.com. And I think if you really want to sort of understand the underlying dynamics of why markets are behaving as they do, rather than what you get from the popular press, the propaganda primarily that you get from the press, that's the place to go, is goldmoney.com, the research page, every Thursday. Thank you, Alistair, for joining us once again.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
It's really good to have you. I'd like to ask you a little bit about an article on the 21st of April you wrote, Value Destruction. It seems to me that, and you said interest rates are really, it starts with interest rates, I think is the way you put it. And interest rates have been manipulated downward for decades, I would say, since 1980, when we had those, in the U.S. at least. I guess your cycle a little different in the U.K., but in 1980 with Paul Volcker finally putting an end to the enormous amount of money printing under Burns and G. William Miller, the Federal Reserve chairman of that time. And we were getting double-digit inflation, and there was really a great concern that this thing could really get away from us and even come to a hyperinflationary sort of condition. And Paul Volcker put his foot on the brakes and stopped printing money and left the interest rates rise to levels that were, far above above the inflation rate. And now we have exactly the opposite as they did then. So I'm wondering if you could just maybe talk a little bit about, just briefly sort of explain the Keynesian philosophy and how that contributed to the mess we're in right now.
Well, it sort of started with Keynesian philosophy, but the problem is Keynesian philosophy is rather like trying to nail a jelly to the wall. It changes depending on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Really, I think the characteristic from of markets from the early 1980s, after that peak in interest rates, was the financialization of markets and bank activities. The Glass-Steagall Act was rescinded, I think, under Carter, and that was, 1991, 92, something like right. that? Not Carter, sorry.
That was under, yeah.
I'm getting my decade.
Clinton, yes, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, we had Big Bang in London, which basically allowed banks to buy stockbrokers. And so really banks, they switched from lending to business progressively towards lending for purely financial activities. And of course, the lending opportunities for business were really sort of disappearing as far as the big banks were concerned, because manufacturing was all being outsourced to Southeast Asia, China, whatever. So they really financialized the whole thing. And of course, the thing that's really been good for a banking system which is completely financialized is the trend of interest rates, because really what it's meant is that any collateral that a bank has against its loans or against repos or whatever it might be continues to increase in value over time because of falling interest rates. Mm-hmm. We've now come to an end of that process, and this is a very, very important point. Now that we've come to an end in that process, we find that prices measured even by a subdued consumer price index are rising multiples above where the central banks are allegedly targeting, and they don't actually know how to respond to this. The big problems are really in Japan, where they still have negative interest rates, and where the Bank of Japan has said that it will keep the 10-year JGB yield suppressed at 0.25%. No big figure, 0.25%. And that basically means that they're sacrificing the currency, and you just got to look at the chart of the yen against the dollar to see that that's the case. And also, the ECB is doing exactly the same thing. They're holding on to their negative -0.5% deposit rate. Consequently, the euro is going down as well. And this, I mean, the idea that the dollar is strong at the moment is actually less the case. It's more the a case that it's other currencies which are collapsing faster than the dollar, because prices, the purchasing power of the dollar is diminishing the whole time. I mean, your CPI rate of inflation is what, 9% or something?
About that. I think we get another reading tomorrow, I think.
I keep on losing track of the figures, but we all know that the statistics basically, you can't rely on them. But we do know one thing, and that is that with the purchasing power of currencies falling in the way they are, interest rates will have to rise. And we're not talking about a rise to 3%. We're not talking to 4%, 5%, 6%. We're talking about a blue sky rise. We don't know where it is going to go. The consequence of that, of course, is value destruction in the financial assets, which the whole of the global banking system has been gobbling up as collateral for the last, 30, 40 years. So, mm-hmm. You can see that there are the makings of a rather nasty crisis. And, I mean, just put yourself in the shoes of the Bank of Japan. They've been doing QE since the year 2000. They have got enormous quantities of bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds, and even equities on their balance sheet. They cannot afford to see the value destruction that is about to be wreaked upon them. And It is actually, for a central banker, it's a terrifying prospect because, I mean, okay, they can recapitalize it, but, they'll be recapitalizing the Bank of Japan at a time when undoubtedly the same problems are hitting the commercial banking sector in Japan, where the global systemically important banks, the big international banks, have asset to equity ratios well in excess of 20 times. Mm-hmm. They cannot afford to see the value destruction which is now occurring. And so you've got a central bank in trouble, and it's meant to be rescuing, if you like, ensuring that no bank fails. Mm-hmm. This is not a good situation to be in. And of course, I think we've talked about this before. The situation in the Eurozone is even worse because the ECB doesn't have a government to turn to. Its shareholders are the other national central banks, and the national central banks are in exactly the same position as the ECB. They are becoming rapidly insolvent, or their equity on the balance sheet is, properly valued, is now negative. Again, you have a banking system with global systemically important Eurozone banks with asset to equity ratios well in excess of 20 times. Oh. This is not good. We cannot afford to see interest rates rise as much as they are going to. And that is, it's the end of this financialization era. And there's a guy from Credit Suisse called Zoltan Pozsar who called this, the ending of Bretton Woods II. Bretton Woods II being from 1971 to the current date, and the emergence of Bretton Woods III, where the global monetary system is going to move more towards commodities and away from financial assets. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is absolutely right. I mean, he put it in such a way which I think quite a lot of people find hard to understand. Mm-hmm. But if you think in terms of what the Russians are doing and what the Chinese are doing, I mean, particularly the Russians, they've cast themselves adrift from this financialization. Mm-hmm. And they've insisted on commoditizing, in effect, their ruble, which is now more or less linked to the gold, to the oil price. And the result is that the ruble is now stronger than it was before the invasion of Ukraine.
Right. Exactly right. But the central banks are going to fight this thing tooth and nail, though, Alistair. They're going to fight. They're going to just, I mean, they're going, at what point are they going to give up? I mean, at what point are they going to realize that when the currency goes to zero? I mean, what's going to have, is it going to have to be like the Mississippi bubble situation before they finally give up?
Well, it's exactly the same dynamics, yeah, for sure, but on a global scale. I mean, John Law basically got control over the currency as well as running the, if you like, the sort of the forerunner of a modern central bank. Mm-hmm. And so he used the printing press to print currency, the livre currency, and also credit to go into the market and buy shares to support the share price of his Mississippi venture. And inevitably what happened was that it destroyed the currency. And that's, we're seeing the same dynamics. I think the course is perhaps not a sort of, you know, a sort of, if you like, an uninterrupted straight line decline. We are going to get a crisis in the middle of this. And I think the crisis is going to be a major, major problem. And I think the elements to it are the ending of the financialization, banks finding that their collateral is collapsing in value, the banks themselves needing rescuing, and the central banks having absolutely no alternative but to bail out the whole of the banking system. Mm-hmm. I would say there's a slight caveat, and that is that after the Lehman crisis, all the G20 member nations passed laws authorizing central banks to do bail-ins.
Yes. Now,
if they go down that route, I'm afraid, either way, the whole thing's going to come apart. But if they try and go down that route, they will create another crisis, because any bondholder in a bank is going to just want to get the hell out of it. Yeah. Because he's not going to want his bonds turned into worthless equity. Mm-hmm. So that's roughly, you know, I think we're going to have a crisis, and the crisis, I don't know, I just feel that it's not very far away. Mm-hmm. I see things unraveling in the way I expect them to unravel. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the markets beginning to wake up to the interest rate problem. And, next, I think it's going to be the banking system. And we're already seeing this beginning to happen on major currencies, particularly the euro and the Japanese yen.
Right. And as the currencies go down, of course, that means the purchasing power. You've got a restless population and a democratic system where people, I mean, it certainly seems to be all of a sudden here there is a recognition that inflation wasn't transitory, that it was going to get worse, it was getting worse. And I think there's still a lot of false hope, perhaps, that somehow we're going to be able to get this under control, back under 2% inflation rates or whatever they're talking about. It just doesn't seem as though that can happen. Of course, they'll try price controls and all manner of other things as well to try to stop this thing from taking place. But do you see any hope? And I'm wondering, you know, right now the Fed is taking a tougher stance, it seems, at least rhetorically it is. Do you think that we might have to see some sort of a financial crisis meltdown before the Fed gets scared and starts turning around and putting QE back into effect? Because it seems to me the Fed is most concerned about the member banks.
Yes, I think that's right. But I think the crisis actually starts not with the dollar and the Fed. I think it starts with Japan and the Eurozone. And we're talking about two enormous, enormous monetary system counterparties to the American banking system. So the idea that the problems in Japan and the problems in the Eurozone are going to stop there, we can forget that. And I think, I mean, underlying this, we've got ourselves into this position, Jay, because nobody understands inflation. They don't mm-hmm. understand what alters the purchasing power of a currency.
Right.
You know, they think, a monetarist will tell you that it's the quantity of money. Now, the quantity of money obviously has a huge, great influence. But actually, what really can happen, and I think what we will see happening, is that people will just lose confidence in their currencies. And because they're not backed by money, legal money, and legal money is gold and nothing else, they will, at some stage, I think, just want to get the hell out of currencies and get into whatever they can before the prices rise, before things are not available, whatever. I mean, whatever will cause the stampede out of currencies, you're going to see it. And that will be what destroys their purchasing power.
Well, it's a certain amount of pain. Trillions of dollars of paper money in the financial markets already disappearing. It's got to be some angst among a lot of people already. And, it hasn't been that much of a decline yet. But, I guess the NASDAQ is down 24% or something like that. So that's not nothing. But Michael Oliver thinks that we could be headed for one of the most serious declines ever in American history. But I don't know if that's overstating it or not. Who knows for sure? But another article, the latest one that you wrote, Financial War Takes a Nasty Turn. And this really, I guess, has a lot to do with the financial war that's going on between the powers, so the United States, NATO, the Western world, and the Asian markets. You started out this article, you said, and I quote, "The chasm between Eurasia and the Western defense groups, NATO, Five Eyes, and AUKUS, is widening rapidly. While media commentary focuses on the visible side of the conflict in the Ukraine, the economic and financial aspects are what really matters." Can you talk about that a little bit with the few minutes we have left?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, this has been a financial war. And of course, nobody really comments on the financial aspects of the geopolitical situation. Simply because, if you've got a newspaper readership, I mean, they understand war in the more physical sense, but to try and get a message over, and particularly when journalists don't actually understand it either. It's not surprising that this aspect of it has been neglected, and very, very badly neglected. But there is no doubt that the Russians and the Chinese have long had this sort of view that they needed to have a nuclear option, and I mean a financial nuclear option, not a physical nuclear option, to protect themselves. And it is for this reason that the Chinese have accumulated huge amounts of gold off balance sheet, as it were. The Russians, I understand, I'm told, have also. Now, I can't verify this, but I am told by sources which I have found in the past to be reliable that the Russians have got an extra 10,000 to 12,000 tons of gold off balance sheet. Now, that is more than the declared amount that the US government has. I've known this for some time, and it always struck me that if the worst comes to the worst, then China and Russia would back their currencies with gold, and we would all sink as a result. It's not playing out that way. Instead of gold, they are using commodities, if you like, as the equivalent of gold. And this is the importance of the move to link the ruble to the price of oil. And in my view, I think that the price of oil is likely to go considerably higher. Now, I know that the Keynesians will say that, the economy is going into recession and that means lower prices. No, it doesn't mean lower prices. What happens is the purchasing power of the currencies falls. Yeah. That is why you're going to get higher prices, irrespective of how the economy is playing out. And the Russians know this. And what they're doing is they're divorcing themselves from the West. And in divorcing themselves from the West, they will have interest rates which are falling while ours are rising. They will have a far sounder economy without the transfer of wealth through the inflation factor from ordinary citizens into the government's hands. Putting the whole thing together, you have got the world's largest exporter of commodities saying, we're going to base our currency on commodities. And China is the largest exporter of manufactured and semi-manufactured goods, and they will be doing exactly the same. Xi and Putin are working together, and there is absolutely no way we can defeat that. And I just I think we have lost the financial war. That is what I now see. So they are playing the nuclear option in the financial war. It is, you know, it is not a nuclear option in the physical sense.
Right. All right. We're going to have to leave it go at that, Alistair. I think people really need to check out your work at the Gold Money website every Thursday. And there's a lot of detail in what Alistair was just talking about. The financial war takes a nasty turn, and how, if we went to a gold standard, it would, what would need to unfold for that to happen. But in the meantime, it is a commodity-backed currency, and the ruble is getting strong, while the financial-backed currencies are really going in the opposite direction. Alistair, thank you so much for spending time with us once again. Always great to have you. The insights are really very, very valuable, so thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Sorry. All right, folks, we'll have to leave it go with that. Next week, Kevin Duffy will be my main guest. He's a coffee can portfolio, and he also is a hedge fund manager, done very well in the past during these kinds of markets, so you want to hear what he has to say. Maybe a surprise guest like Bob Moriarty or someone else will join me as well. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.